Peace and love, everyone. Welcome to yet another episode of In Defense of Liberation, the show that is working towards and educating about true people's liberation movements and revolution. I am your host, Raven. Thank you so much for tuning into the program. So for folks who are new, it looks like I kind of have gotten a few new listeners. Just a brief introduction. We are a podcast over here, I'm not a historian, I'm not an academic, I'm a worker, I was a student for some time, and I was actually raised evangelical, so this has been a process to get here, and this is a forum, a space for conversation. So this is always an open invitation to come on the program, to share your thoughts, to share your critiques even of me, etc., of the movement, of organizations, and also and especially to come on and share messages of hope and encouragement. So please do reach out. That's at indefenseofliberation@gmail.com, where you could primarily find me. You could also message me on Instagram, In Defense of Liberation. But yeah, other than that, again, for folks who are kind of new coming in after probably me being on Activist News Network, which do want to take a moment to shout out Ryan over at ANN, me and the comrade Sophia from About the People, the subcommittee within Spirit of Mandela, hopped on to speak about our welcome home party and screening of our special feature, Who is Mumia, which was last Saturday at Maisel's Documentary Center. So I want to give a big shout out to Maisel's. That was awesome. Maisel's is down in Harlem. They got a lot of great events that folks can check out. Again, that is Maisel's Documentary Center. And I think the discussion which we had with Ryan was fruitful because it really led us to talking about a lot of different things. It was intended to be a quite short discussion, and then it ended up going on for, I believe, just shy or just barely above an hour. So if folks want to check that out, you can go over to Activist News Network on YouTube. Please subscribe to Ryan. Great program, great interviews, great discussion always. But yeah, that screening was at Maisel's. That was a wonderful event. A lot of good, you know, warm spirits were there, living it up, eating food, listening to music, watching the screening, and talking about organizing. So for folks who want to learn more about the Spirit of Mandela or the About the People subcommittee, please go to spiritofmandela.org. You can also email spiritofmandela1@gmail.com. No caps or spaces in that. Or you can email aboutthepeople1312, no caps or spaces, @gmail.com. Very proud of the work that's being done over there and happy to be a part of it. So anyways, other than that, there are a lot of things going on. Of course, we are ever focusing on the genocide happening in Palestine. We are incredibly heartbroken by the over 20,000 confirmed dead, the over 60,000 injured and contained under rubble, and the million almost plus people who have been displaced from northern Gaza, many of whom were already refugees coming from areas further north like Haifa and Jaffa, who were displaced in 1948, who were ethnically cleansed from their land from the earliest onset of European immigration, of Russian immigration, of Jewish Zionists, and settlers who stole land through buying up large absentee land from landlords in surrounding areas and founding settlements, but also, of course, founding military wings like the Haganah, as well as more radical groups who went out and assassinated leaders of the Palestinian movement, harassed and abused Palestinian people, who tortured and terrorized the population in order to remove them from their land. And as we continue in what will be our conversation for today, Colonial Connections Part 3, we must also lift up here and have been lifting up the fact that in history, Palestine is not the only genocide. And today, in the present, Palestine is not the only ongoing genocide. And we do not say this to come on the program and turn eyes away, turn attention or energy away from the Palestinian people. In fact, we encourage people to find whatever ways they can get a hold of organizations, get a hold of humanitarian groups, get a hold of your elected officials. Do whatever it is that is within your wheelhouse, within your power. And remember that at the end of the day, by being active, by being involved, we are learning lessons, we are coming to stronger conclusions about things, and we are inching ourselves closer and closer to more correct, more practical, more productive strategies and tactics. So as we continue to see the rise, the falling, the dip, as we might call it, and the rise again in different protest movements, different boycott movements, different social media campaigns, we must understand that there is an objective necessity for long-term, concrete, principled organization, that we cannot simply rise and fall with the times, that we cannot simply step up and then sit down with the energy of the masses, but that we must continuously be a breath of fresh air, continuously be like kindling, continuously be agitating, educating, building relationships with people, but especially building intelligent, correctly, and well-founded, principled organizations. Without the ability to continue organizing, even in the low moments, without a space to keep energy pushing forward, we will see the same results that we have seen throughout history. When a people rise up and then eventually go back to work or feel that they have elected their change in, or at the very least, leave the streets. Stop focusing on the urgency. That is when a Biden or an Obama can come in and take advantage of the popular sentiment, co-opt it towards their own goals, and use it actually to not show people that the electoral system is corrupt, even though it might be obvious to many, but use this co-optation, this election, legislative changes to further strengthen the faith that people have in the state, what we call the government or the courts or the judiciary or the Congress or the Senate, what have you. We must have long-term revolutionary organizations that in all moments are consciously aware of the needs of the people, are meeting and building relationships with those around them, and are drawing in the creativity, the participation, the ideas, and the leadership of everyday people who are coming into their own. And I am happy to see more and more that around the world this is happening. I'm happy to see that although suffering is like ever increasing, statistically speaking, the average life is one of higher poverty, less availability to resources like healthcare, housing, education, internet, water, electricity. In the most so-called progressive, advanced industrialized societies even, we see that this wealth, this technology, this information is hoarded by a certain group within society. And the rest of the population is forced to make ends meet with what little opportunities, resources, and wealth that they may have, oftentimes really only being contained in their ability to sell their labor power. But anyways, today we're here to talk part three on colonial connections. So for folks who haven't, you can check out the first few episodes of this series. I'm pulling them up on my laptop now to remember the names. The first one is called Colonial Connections, an intro to the relations of colonialism, capitalism, fascism, and Zionism. The second is called Colonial Connections Part 2, Economic Foundations of Colonialism. Today, we are going to be talking about, first and foremost, a deeper analysis of the origins of fascism, fascist collaboration with so-called Israel, and the development of neo-colonial, neo-fascist states like Israel. We are then going to talk about misleadership and the destruction of legitimate political, social, religious, and other leaders within the movement to liberate Palestine. We're going to talk about more to do with the logic of resistance, more to do with what war is and what revolution is. We're going to talk about the role of society and people within society in struggles. And then we are going to cap off with what really is anti-communism and why it applies to non-communists. So where we left off last time, we had covered colonialism's forms, its economic foundations, and its functions. We talked about Europe's internal wars and colonialism. We talked about class society, its history, and its logics. We talked about Zionism's intro and early existence. And we talked in depth a bit about the variation and the differences that set settler colonialism above and beyond other forms of colonialism that have historically developed. So we're working with some notes today. We're working with some quotes today. But before we get into it, I want to read, and I'm gonna try my best, because these words are particularly difficult to read sometimes. But the poetry that I've been so lucky to receive through email, through the Bring Mumia Home Collective listserv, and also has been shared by Palestinians around the world on social media, on interviews. And I want to read two poems, both from Mossab Abu Toha. So if you don't know Mossab, you can look up some information about him. He was kidnapped and tortured and beaten by the IDF. He has thankfully been released. However, this kind of experience and treatment is something that stays and will stay with all the people who are suffering it for the rest of their lives. So this is his poem, Memorize Your Dream. Close your eyes and walk on the ocean. Dabble your hands in the water and catch your poem's words. Write the words up on the clouds. Don't worry, they will find their land. Open your eyes in the night. The sea is no longer blue. Look around, and from the descending raindrops, pick your punctuation marks. Put on your swimsuit, dive deep down, and look for a title for your epic. Embark on your moving homeland, your boat. Go to your bed, and in your sleep, begin to memorize your dream. This one is one that I sent in to Betty Davis and Ralph Pointer's radio show on WBAI, which folks can check out. But this is Leaving Childhood Behind by Mossab Abu Toha. When I left my childhood in the drawer. And on the kitchen table, I left my toy horse in its plastic bag. I left without looking at the clock. I forget whether it was noon or evening. Our horse spent the night alone. No water, no grains for dinner. It must have thought we'd left to cook a meal for late guests or to make a cake for my sister's 10th birthday. I walked with my sister down our road with no end. We sang a birthday song. The warplanes echoed across the heavens. My tired parents walked behind. My father clutching to his chest, the keys to our house and to the stable. We arrived at a rescue station. News of the airstrikes roared on the radio. I hated death, but I hated life too. When we had to walk to our drawn-out death, reciting our never-ending ode. So, Mossab actually also helped, I believe he was the founder of the Edward Said Library, which is Gaza's only English language library. I don't know the status of the library at the moment. Let me see if there is any information about it. But as we've seen, the people who are being massacred in Palestine, although the state of Israel is not necessarily so worried about who they're killing, there's also a direct target on the backs of journalists. We've seen, I believe, 84, 85, possibly more, already in these 2 months assassinated. Almost 3 months. We have also seen that academics, poets, musicians, artists, students are all being targeted, especially for their ability to communicate to the outside world what is happening. Today, as we talk about fascism, we're going to talk about some of the not so necessarily often discussed shades and sides to fascism that in a history classroom, in a public school, or a university, unless you have a particularly educated and revolutionary or radical professor, you would likely not focus on these characteristics, if even bring them up at all. When we had previously talked about the history of colonialism, we of course talked about the especially violent and physical forms of control, of exploitation, of murder, of torture. And we touched on some of the more mental, emotional, spiritual forms of control and colonialism. But when we talk about something like fascism, one of the most potent aspects is its emotional and psychological forms of manipulation and also the way in which fascism plays on the emotional and mental state of the oppressed masses, using terminology, phrases, names of political parties to draw in a mass base, a broad base of working and oppressed people. Only to turn their movement, their struggles, on their head, and instead of having a real revolution, fascism has a counter-revolution on the behalf of the capitalist and ruling class. It uses the sentiments of the people in order to turn them against one another. So, when we look at where we are today, right? We, of course, need to look at the past in order to understand the present. However, we cannot apply formulaically, like loosely, copy and paste, the same idea to every situation, the same analysis of every phenomenon, at every point and period in time that it pops up. We have to study deeply the historical ties, divisions, interests, rule, structure, governments, etc., to clearly recognize what is happening today. Because without that history, without that knowledge, we can't properly analyze today. But if we coldly and absent-mindedly try to apply the same tactics, the same strategies to today, we are sorely mistaken, to say the least. Excuse me. The process of settler colonialism and the history of colonialism up until the 1800s, late 1800s, early 1900s, was a new level, a new development as far as the phenomenons of colonialism and imperialism were concerned. As we talked about last time, imperialism and colonialism are not phenomenons that appeared randomly in 1492 and after the end of World War I. These forms of oppression, these forms of government structure, these systems of oppression and control and domination and exploitation are simply reinventions, readjustments of previous strategies and tactics. And what we have to understand the most about this is that the reason is because, in general, the ruling class is not, first of all, a monolith. It's not like a group of people all agreeing and moving simultaneously on the same path forward. You can look at an election season, or look at a scandal that comes out, or look at an attempt to pass legislation, and you can see that in general, the ruling class often disagrees amongst itself, has contradictory, if even minimally, even just, you know, small differences between their interests and their approaches to getting their interests. Throughout history, this contradiction and the contradiction between the average day of a worker or the average day of an unemployed person or the average day of an enslaved person versus the picture that is painted for them, the ideas that they're taught, the things that they are told that their life is going to be, that is going to come out of this struggle, that their hard work will earn them. These contradictions have been taken advantage of and used as a basis to push portions of the masses to fight against whatever leadership existed at the time, with whatever tools and strategies the people chose at the time, to shift in some way the status quo, the way things were, how things were structured. And every single time this has happened, where either the entire system has not been toppled and replaced with something else, or it has been, and then it has been re-overthrown in a counter-revolution. In these situations where the former ruling class that was struggled against, that was fought against, is able to retain power, a few things are true. First of all, for those of you who think we can have some kind of peaceful process whereby we are just going to have our lives spared, there are no revolutionaries and radicals who sincerely oppose the system at large who are left to continue organizing, educating, advancing their causes. They are either killed outright, incarcerated, or they are exiled. The second thing that's true is that those in charge who have been able to, you know, fight their way back to the helm now have lessons to learn. And as they discuss and develop some kind of new obstacle, new maneuver to trick or control the people into supporting the system, and that now becomes a part of how what we call the state operates. So, for example, in previous times throughout history, a nation did not necessarily have a consistent standing army. In many periods in time, things like drafts were very common. You would have career soldiers, maybe generals, you know, higher ups. But if a real war effort were to come about, you would maybe have volunteers or do a draft, right? And even when some militaries, right, began to exist, they often did not necessarily have allegiance to the larger state, but would in fact oftentimes have allegiance to certain specific groups or even individual people, such as the president, the king, the prince, the Shah. So eventually, after revolutions took place around the world, the governments and the ruling classes that retained power came to the understanding that having a standing military ready to go, trained and equipped for anything at any moment, and this includes also the police, the National Guard, the other armed wings of the state, and even the right-wing, extreme fascist types, the white supremacists, the KKK members, the Proud Boys, who they themselves are non-military, non-police, but they will act like the brown shirts, they will act like fascist thugs in any other nation. They will go around killing activists and organizers, trade unionists, abolitionists. They will harass and abuse young people, elderly folks. They will attack public events, and they've been known to even kill people. This is opportune and important for the ruling class, because now at any moment's time, they have guns trained and armed, prepared to be used. So other examples exist as well. I'm of the belief that so-called democracy and elections, as they exist in capitalist nations today, are also a readjustment, a tool, a mirage, a theater that the state has created to keep us under their control. I personally am of the belief that so-called democracy can only exist in a specifically socialist system. That is it. in a socialist project constructing itself. That is the only possibility where real democracy, real elections, real government can be had, which is not corrupt in its very root. I think that also we have to, because of this, understand that many of our strategies, many of our tactics are not new. That is, those of us who are organizing. Many of the ideas and efforts we are putting out there are repetitions of the past. And now, this is not just to say, like, oh, that shit's old news or whatever. Like, I'm not trying to play, like that person who says, like, oh, I was a fan of that band before they got popular. Like, my point is just that if we expect that with very little experience, very little study, very little relationship building, that we are going to step, fall, and stumble onto the just totally correct path towards liberation, you're playing yourself. And when you're also going out here and doing things that the ruling class has seen, not once, not twice, not three times, but 50, 100, 150 times for hundreds of years, you are putting yourself and everyone else there at risk. Because the state is prepared. Why do you think so many people are getting busted down and arrested? Why do you think people are getting killed at protests? Because the state is ready and willing to do what they need to do to prevent this from moving forward. Now, what we'll get into and talk about more later is that, in fact, they are shooting themselves and us in the feet, abdomen, chest, and head, because ultimately the continued violence and oppression against people who are just asking for literally the bare minimum decency of human existence as someone looking to determine their own destiny and live life with human dignity, who are getting shot at, arrested, beaten, abused, made fun of online, lied about, miscredited, discredited, treated terribly behind bars and locked up for long times, for large amounts of money to be paid in order to get out. We need to be very cautious about this notion that we just need to do something. The last point I will make on this is just to say, the right-wing organizations and individuals who have posted photos online with sniper scopes and rifles fixed directly on large congregations of unarmed, unprotected, peaceful demonstrators in a central location with not even vehicles or barricades surrounding them. You are putting people in the line of fire. And I'm not saying that people shouldn't be there. But what I'm saying is, how many marches, how many protests have been shot down around the world? Be smart. Be cautious. prepare yourself. So, as I said, the state learns from these lessons. The state learns from the attempted struggles and revolutions, not only here, but around the world. Because the state has the international connections, the government, the ruling class, the politicians, the industrialists, the capitalists, the monopolies, the bankers. They have relationships with people all over the world in the same or similar positions within the ruling class that they are in as well. Talking about these lessons, talking about how to take these down. I want to bring up a document just really quick. Because I think that a lot of us really don't think too heavily about this. You know, we kind of sometimes think that the state is very dumb. But there's currently a document which was released by nonviolentconflict.org, the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict, and the Atlantic Council, called Fostering a Fourth Democratic Wave: A Playbook for Countering the Authoritarian Threat. And just reading off some organizations who are represented here. Of course, we have the International Center for Nonviolent Conflict, the National Democratic Institute, the Alliance of Democracies Foundation, the Atlantic Council, the Swedish International Development Cooperation Agency, Open Societies Foundations, the International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance, European Endowment for Democracy, Danish Institute for Parties and Democracy, the International Center for Not-for-Profit Law, the Freeman Spogel Institute and Hoover Institution at Stanford University, the Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security, Freedom House, Humanity United, Westminster Foundation for Democracy, Human Rights Watch, World Liberty Congress, International Research and Exchange Board, the Carter Center, International Republican Institute, the National Endowment for Democracy, and Citizen Power Initiatives for China. The president was Derek Mitchell, Daniel Twining, who shared some kind of level of control over this document with Lisbeth Pillegard and Damon Wilson. So this is a document basically analyzing the revolutions and movements for democracy throughout the past decade, 20 years, what has failed, what has succeeded, and how to push this forward. Now, this is important because one of the things they focus on is the primary necessity to involve themselves with grassroots organizing. If you don't think that these very same strategies have and are currently being applied in our neighborhoods right now to co-opt the movement, to push energy away from struggle, then you're lying to yourself. Okay. We got pretty off track. Jumping back to the history of colonialism and how the state learns. Eventually, the state gets to a point where it is no longer capable and willing to try to eliminate people through peaceful means or through just plain out manipulation. Around the world, the extermination campaign that is happening right now in Palestine is not the first example of an extermination campaign. Now, it tends not to be practical for a colonial power to annihilate the entire population of the colonized people for a couple different reasons. First, of course, the thing that really ties together colonists is the ability to colonize. If they have no one to colonize, if all of the land is taken, eventually they will begin to colonize one another. Second, the existence of colonized people is, of course, promising for the colonizers also because they are a labor force. They are a population which can be exploited. They are a bad guy that can be painted on every wall in order to terrify and intimidate the population of the colonizing nation in order to further colonize the land and the people. Fascism is not disconnected from any other extermination campaign, colonial project, imperialist entity, capitalist nation. The term fascism and the very first remnants of what we call fascism are commonly attributed to 1920s and 1930s Italy. And I will give historians this. Likely, this is probably one of the very first times in at least a long time in European history that this word was chosen to describe this phenomenon. But fascism is intrinsic to European colonialism, and it is in fact intrinsic to exploitation and colonization everywhere. Because what fascism is, oftentimes you hear people call it capitalism in crisis. But what it really comes down to is fascism is an attempt by the ruling class to convince the population to not only really sell their souls, sell all hope, give up all organization and opportunity at a revolution, under the impression that what they're giving that up for, that action of attacking one another, destroying trade unionist work, destroying socialist organizations, destroying revolutionary movements, is portrayed as a revolution in and of itself. However, as we pointed out, fascism is in fact a counter-revolution. It is a revolution or a final solution on behalf of the ruling class. Hitler, Mussolini, Franco, Pinochet, all the fascist leaders did not come about through a process of individual power accumulation, exploitation, and extermination. Fascism is a natural reaction to crises within the system, which cannot be resolved through any other mechanism but outright force and removing and revoking any control, any rights, any power, any organization that the general population has in order to fully entrench that wealth, that power, that organization back into the hands of the colonial masters. Now, in the case of Italy, Germany, Portugal, Spain, France, these nations, right, each had their own specific characteristics, variations, forms of fascism. But it is the things that they had in common, the things that they had similar, which we must focus on. Now, the four first ones are, let me get this up here. So the first four are as follows: glorification of the leadership cult, glorification of the nation state, glorification of military conquest and what we call jingoism. 4, propagation of folk mysticism, xenophobia, and racism. But the fifth one is, of course, what we have a particular interest in discussing today, which is in opposition to socialism, communism, anarchism, all left egalitarian class movements, trade unions, labor parties, and working class political organizations. As we mentioned, points 1 through 4 are normally discussed. This is talked about further in a documentary done by Michael Parenti, which I would ask, you know, everyone to really check out. But for our purposes today, it's important to understand that these characteristics are not set in stone. That as the state reforms and readjusts itself to attack and approach the revolutionary struggles that are happening within its borders and around the world, fascism, as a result, as a consequence of being a process of the state's attempt to retain full control, also follows the same formula, the same process throughout time, where every time a fascist nation has been overthrown, every time an anti-fascist struggle has been engaged in, lessons have been learned. And so now there are many fascists who we might call Democrats. Joe Biden is a fascist. But because Joe Biden is not the charismatic, Hitler-like, Mussolini-like figure that you have in your mind, that we have in our minds, many people would deny that and say, no, he's just, he's just pro-capitalist. He's just an imperialist. But the difference between imperialist and fascist are so small that one just really needs to understand what those two words mean to kind of come to the same conclusion that we're coming to here, which is that the fascism that existed in Europe in the 20s and 30s, as we've talked about on the show before, is not the fascism of today. George Jackson, Comrade Field Marshal George Jackson, spoke about how fascism in the United States context, really, down to its very foundation, is its ability to reform itself, to continue stealing land from the indigenous and massacring the indigenous people, to continue to massacre African peoples and incarcerate them, to push drugs into the communities of Latinos, of Chicanos, of Asian folks, of immigrants. The ability for the education system, the healthcare system, the housing system, all to be completely devoid of any and all human and working or oppressed people's needs. The fact that profits more than ever before are above and beyond life. The pandemic alone could help us to understand this more and more. Because what allows a fascist nation like the United States to confuse and mislead us into conceptualizing it as a democratic or even in some cases at one point in history, some folks would call it a revolutionary nation. The ability for this oppressing state to convince its population of these lies speaks to the stronger proof that this nation is and should be characterized as fascist. Because even the German state teaches about Nazis. Now, do they cover everything? I'm sure not. But the difference between an education in the United States and an education in Germany is the awareness in Germany of the average person that Nazism happened, came, and took control over average people like you and me. Whereas in a United States, I can speak from my experience, that fascism seems like, and is taught almost as if, it is a historical phenomenon, which is no longer, and one that was specifically tied to Germany and Italy. That is it. If they talk about Japan, if they talk about Portugal, if they talk about Spain, it is in a passing comment. But they almost create the idea that it is only Germans and only Italians who can be fascist. Or at the very least, they create this sense of misguided realism where we believe that fascism came and was, when in fact fascism, like imperialism, like colonialism, are historic phenomenons which come and reinvent themselves, and when they are defeated, if they are defeated, find a new place in the world to cultivate their lessons, to develop new strategies, and to reinvent themselves to take power again. That has to be seen when we are looking at the Zionist entity in so-called Israel, in Palestinian land. And this is not just to say a controversial statement. Two things are historically true. One, the process, behaviors, programs, policies, and power that the Zionist entity has developed and used to occupy the land of the Palestinian people is tantamount to the exact same thing that the Nazis did throughout Eastern Europe. The second thing that is historically true is that Hitler, Eichmann, and other members of the National Socialist Workers' Party, the NSDLP, the Nazi Party, in Nazi Germany, as late as 1947, had a direct hand in the assistance of the Zionist entity to take unwanted populations of Jewish emigres, of refugees, often who had some amount of wealth or were deemed unneeded, aka elderly, children, disabled folks, which they helped bring to settle and occupy Palestine. That was the Nazis who directly assisted and aided the Zionists in developing their occupying state, now known as Israel. And so this is not just to cause alarm, to cause some kind of controversy. These historical precedents, these historical actions must be noted down, must be seen as part and parcel of what exists today. If we really want to know what is happening in Palestine, if we really want to know how that affects us today, we have to study history. History not only of oppression, but also of resistance. Now, as we come to a close on these points about specifically fascism, as we have talked about them in depth before, I want to talk about some of the different parts of the new stage we are in today historically, to some depth, as they relate not only to Palestine, but also different liberation movements happening around the world. Now, I want to say that all of my information is coming from sources. I mean, Norman Finkelstein is doing his fucking due diligence and has been for some time. He's not my favorite. He is still pretty liberal, but his historical analysis of Palestine is just, in many ways, unmatched by any other European person, by any other white person. I have also been reading The Hundred Years' War by Rashid Khalid. Been watching a lot from the electronic, well, listening to a lot from the Electronic Intifada, and been also very happy to see the analysis coming from different international communist parties, like the Communist Party of Kenya, and through conversation that I've been able to have with a lot of important people in my life, who either have direct ties to Palestine, who have been to Palestine, who have been organizing around Palestine for some time, who are in the political prisoner movement, who were in the Panthers, in the BLA, people who, like, understand that for 100-plus years now, the settlement of Palestine, the occupation of Palestine, and the resistance of the Palestinian people has played an international and world historic role, positive and negative. So, kind of looking at my list of what we want to talk about, I want to first hit on war and revolution and the logic of resistance before going into some more negativity. And then we'll cap it off with anti-communism and some other shit. So, okay, the logic of resistance is pretty basic, pretty simple. We learn it in chemistry, in physics, in biology, astronomy, calculus, algebra. The logic of resistance can be seen in the smallest act of defiance of a child to the Al-Qassam Brigade's Al-Aqsa flood operation, led hand in hand with other members of resistance factions throughout Palestine. And it essentially goes, if you're going to step on my neck, bully me, put me in chains, insult me, bomb hospitals around me, destroy my religious and historical artifacts, locations, destroy knowledge, destroy libraries, destroy schools, abuse children, abuse elderly folks, abuse women, abuse the disabled community, if you are going to oppress me or anyone else, you must expect a reaction. And not just a reaction, right? Because we are at a period in time where oppression is not new. The Palestinians have been enduring what they are enduring now for, at least to this extreme, like this level of bombardment, of ground invasion attempts, the siege, the lack of water and electricity, for at least 20 plus years. But explicit occupation for over 75. So, their quote unquote reaction is not simply just that. The resistance by colonized people comes to a point where the lessons are also learned by the resistance. And through the process and the historical development of the different movements and struggles for liberation, eventually, the resistance, as we see in Palestine, comes to certain conclusions which are proven, in fact, through actions taken like October 7th. That is, that an oppressed people can only liberate themselves through first and foremost meeting their oppressor with the same means and measures of violence, as it is called, of force, to be more PC, as is being brought down upon the people. If this cannot be met, this is simple military strategy, right? The average military strategist is going to say we want to meet forces with forces, maybe be more strategic about it, you know, plan it out, do it in a process. But at the very best, at the very least, the goal is to have a force which matches or overpowers your opponent. If this outright military force does not exist in arms, in planes, in naval vessels, and technology, then the second thing has to be true, which is the entire people, the general population, needs to see the struggle as a part of themselves and see themselves as a part of the struggle. Meaning that if someone is not a resistance fighter in Palestine, they are somehow involved in the process of resistance. Meaning they might be doctors, they might be teachers, they might be medical, you know, assistants like EMTs, right? They might be socialists or communists who are organizing on that front. They might be entertainers to bring revolutionary culture to the people. They might be cooks and healers who use natural foods, natural remedies that they can still acquire in order to survive as they have everything else cut off from them. And if you're none of those things, you might raise a child who might become one of those things, or you might house someone who is one of those things and help take care of them. This is the way in which the entire Palestinian population is directly involved in the resistance, in the struggle. This logic comes after a period whereby every other method, or I should say these conclusions are come to after a process whereby every other method, every other path forward is closed. It's kind of like when you are, you know, say you have a friend who you kind of have a very conditional friendship, right? I think a lot of us have this example. Someone you went to school with, maybe someone you grew up with, where the issues that you might have between each other, the disagreements, past experiences and stuff, often are left unspoken about. And one or both, or all people, you know, however many folks are in this friendship, relationship, what have you, get to a point where they feel that every other path forward, communicating, changing behavior, asking for help, all these different things that they have tried or have been shut out from them are exhausted. That is usually the point where fights, altercations, arguments, and the ending of relationships tends to come about. Because similarly to the logic of resistance, the logic of frustration is kind of, if you give me no other option, I'm going to get angry. If you give me no other option, I'm going to resist. So the resistance, as it is so natural, is very often focused on by the ruling class as the, I don't know what you can call it, control group, the experimental group. Essentially, like, that's the rule for how the government acts. If they have some portion of the population that is taking up arms against the government, it becomes a military dictatorship like, say, the Philippines, where you know, all different forms of oppression and exploitation are expanded and broadened, and where what we might call fascism is enacted, right? The same goes for here. If you have a population that is protesting, that is demonstrating, that is doing civil disobedience stuff, the state is going to lock us up. They're just going to, if not worse, you know? So, essentially, the state is watching the organizers, the revolutionaries, the movements, in order to know what they need to be prepared for. One of the most, in my opinion, my humble opinion, successful ways historically of oppression being contained and continued is through misleadership. And this is kind of, you know, part and parcel of fascism as well, but it comes in different forms, right? It can be misleadership in the form of an organization, right, that calls itself the leaders of this community group or this struggle. But when you look at the character of that organization, when you look at the actions that it participates in, you can clearly see that its interests are either with itself or with the ruling class, almost never with the working class. There are other ways where this happens as well. You have a group known as the Congressional Black Caucus, and other groups which fit into what the comrades over on I Mix What I Like, Black Myths podcast, and others in the Black Power media sphere and African revolutionaries have deemed the black misleadership, and it's looked different throughout history. The same is true for indigenous leadership and the leadership of all oppressed people. If and when the population is not in control of its resources, in control of the different facets of power, if they have not organized themselves into a system of governance or a state or some form of autonomous control over themselves, then their so-called leadership, their so-called representatives, do not represent them. Now, there might be one or two people who, okay, they come from the working class, or yeah, they have a pretty anti-capitalist sentiment. But at the end of the day, unless it's the people in power themselves, this is another form of misleadership. The elected officials, the representatives, who really only represent the interests of wealth, the interests of the imperialists. There's also misleadership in education and in social and religious and other spaces where we participate in culture, in learning, in relationships. We have people in our lives, whether they're pastors or teachers or doctors or parents, who mislead us and misrepresent our interests. Now, when you get down to individuals like this, you're oftentimes not talking about always extremely malicious, determined people intent on harm. My mom and dad, for example, have misled me my entire life, have not prepared me for the real world, and that's because they too were misled and not prepared for the world. That is not separate from the ruling class entirely. This need to have some or a lot of the people within the population repeating, believing, practicing, and approaching problems with the, what we might call bourgeois, ruling class, just the general mainstream way of thinking. This constant and common way of approaching issues needs to be let go of. We need to abandon those who have been supposedly leading us to this point, who have allowed for things to not only continue as they were, but in many cases get worse. Neocolonialism, the development of a stronger national bourgeoisie, a national ruling class, whether it be economists or industrialists or bankers or military officials, from Ghana to Australia to Japan to Cambodia to Chile. They've tried it, or they've succeeded in paying off a portion of the wealthy middle class, so to call them. That could be government officials, that could be police officers, that could be teachers, right? To either overthrow or actively oppose their government and work hand in hand with the government of this or that imperialist nation, whether it's France or Canada or the UK or the so-called United States, there's a check that is written to someone, there's a university studies for a child that is given for free, there's military aid that is sent over, something to convince this group of people within the population to, instead of supporting the interests of the general population, to support the interests of another invading nation so that they themselves can make off rich. Now, this often comes either through, during, or after the process of eliminating the legitimate leadership across the different resistance and liberation movements. The example that I want to give is on everybody's favorite group, everybody's favorite organization. The reviews are coming in hot. Hamas. The group that everyone needs to condemn, who I refuse to condemn, is a historic phenomenon. Now, I'm not going to get into the shit with Israel's involvement in actually allowing and supporting Hamas, Netanyahu specifically, in becoming the prominent leadership and group within Palestinian resistance movements. What I am going to talk about is the fact that every single resistance movement, every single group of leaders, every single attempt at negotiation, at addressing problems peaceably that had been attempted by the Palestinian people through to this day has been met with assassination, with brutal campaigns of terror, with further encroachment on land, with more harassment and attempted assassination of not only leaders, but also just individual members of society, and the boogeyman that the colonists need, whether it's in Fatah or in the PFLP or in Hamas. We must understand that the leadership, the non-religious leadership, right? The revolutionary leadership, the non-violent, quote-unquote, non-violent leadership, the parliamentaries, the upper class of Palestinian society, even in the early 1900s, leading up to the actual Nakba. All of these leaders through to today have been systematically assassinated, exiled, and incarcerated, leading the Palestinian people to a situation where they feel more and more as if either A, there's no leadership out here, which many of the Palestinian people do not believe. This is the goal of the Israeli state. Or the second, that they are willing to fall into the hands of maybe not so positive groups that could or have or would come about because of the elimination of other leaders that could be then painted as a more productively bad group, as Hamas is, so that then the colonists have another chart in the good guy side, basically saying that, okay, the idea that Hamas is a terrorist group, right, is still extremely vulnerable and empty as far as proof is concerned, but because they happen to be particularly Islamic, that it is a Islamic resistance movement, the anti-Muslim, anti-Middle Eastern sentiment that has been painted since the Gulf War, since the 90s, since Hussein, since Kuwait, and since 9/11, Iraq, Afghanistan, all these different invasions that have happened, occupations. This has led us to a point where now basically anyone brown is oftentimes seen in this light and can easily be labeled as such. However, the different organizations that existed previously that were not primarily Islamic, were not primarily religious-oriented, and even those who were but weren't taking up arms, for example, could not as easily be painted as terrorists, especially if they're just a bunch of diplomats, right? So the destruction of any and all groups, organizations, and attempts to destroy the organizations that it do exist now is a part of that process of destroying legitimate leadership of people, which, from my opinion, I don't know if this is the case, but honestly should be considered an extremely high crime against humanity, because when so many people are put in a position of vulnerability, of survival, and not given any sort of education, opportunity, leadership, organization, of course the ruling class knows that the people are going to turn into the worst versions of themselves, into the worst versions of humankind that has been created, and start killing one another, start harming one another, start stealing from one another, and start focusing on their own needs above everyone else's. And we're starting and really getting into the groove with this extremely hyper-individualistic sentiment that allows for 20,000 people in Palestine, for over 3 million in the Congo, for 6 million in Sudan, for 1 million in Iraq, for the entire population of Afghanistan to be at a point of starvation, of genocide that they are enduring while the rest of the world looks on. And yeah, people are protesting. But the only people who are legitimately standing with the Palestinian people are the Yemeni forces who are struggling against Israel and the NATO forces. This is solidarity with Palestine in the realest form. Now, we know that war is not just simply bombs and armies and such, that this destruction of legitimate leadership, this kind of closing off of political opportunities, the siege that has been on Gaza for 17 years now, the lack of information and education, the destruction of all the culture and history and traditions of a people, this is a part of war. And so because of this, we must understand that, in fact, revolution is more than just armed struggle. Armed struggle is, in fact, one of the last steps in revolution, one of the very least important parts of a revolution. That is to say, the shortest time period, often. A revolution comes in kind of three different parts. I don't want to call it stages because I'm not saying that it comes in stages and flows deterministically from one point to another. You can look in history at a revolution that has either failed or succeeded and see these three separate parts to it. You can see the prior to, the pre-revolutionary period, the revolutionary period, and the post-revolution construction period. When we look at revolutions all around the world, we see these different parts. We can see, you know, in the Boxer Rebellion and in the National Revolution of China
with the Kuomintang, with the different anti-communist groups that existed, right, as this kind of pre- and revolutionary period in Chinese history. But then from 1922, leading up to 1949, you actually see a counter-revolutionary period. And then by the time you hit the mid-40s to 1949 with the announcement of the People's Republic of China, the revolutionary period has succeeded in overcoming the counter-revolutionary period and reasserting itself, ultimately establishing a state for itself. From that point forward, you have the construction of a post-revolutionary society, where now to actually remain principled is not just to pick up a gun and fight for your life. To remain principled is to study deeply the reality of the situation and figure out how to take society, community, people, education, the economy, production, healthcare, all these different facets of society from where they are to where we want them to go. That is a process that can take generations. And one that will constantly be under threat, facing constant violence, constant siege warfare, constant attempts at coups and counter-revolutions. Because these different periods are so involved, they are extended and expanded, they ebb and they flow, they are overthrown, you know, that energy of revolution, of pre-revolutionary times, building up that anticipation, that agitation, that can be taken away with a military junta or a coup or a fascist dictatorship. But each stage, each kind of period, I ignore that I just used the term stage, please. Each different period, as it flows, circles, comes back, disappears, reappears, is not just simply led primarily by, say, this communist party over here and this government over here. The struggle, just like the struggle in Palestine, must be and is engaged in by society. The role of society in a revolution, the role of culture in a revolution is immense. Art, music, dance, poetry, all these different things, plus just the genuine and simple practice of being with people is incredibly important in the success of a revolution. Because a revolution is not and will never be simply the overthrow of a government or armed struggle. Armed struggle, as Fidel says, is not even the choice of the revolutionaries. It's a choice the revolutionaries are pushed to because all other options at change are closed off by the ruling class. So, struggles all around the world are happening right now, right? You have women's struggles, you have LGBTQ plus struggles, you have struggles for the disabled community, you have struggles for the indigenous nations and peoples of the world, you have struggles against imperialism, you have struggles against climate change. These things are not separate necessarily so, and in fact, we tend to make them that way without even really being told to. Which ultimately benefits our oppressors, right? Society in general should be encompassed into whatever struggle we're talking about. If you are leading a tenant movement in your area, what makes more sense? Involving simply the tenants in the building that you want to organize or trying to involve the general community, whether it be the neighborhood surrounding the area or the city as a whole. And of course, that takes more time, that's not so simple, that doesn't just happen. But if the general population does not support this movement, this organization, this idea,
No one group, no one person, no one struggle is going to change that. People need to see it with their own eyes, time and time again, and involve themselves. Learn lessons of failure. Struggle to come to correct ideas. And actually, more importantly than anything, involve themselves. Participate. Don't just watch, don't just listen, don't just share, but get out there. Do what you can. You know, organize where you're at. And learn. If something doesn't work, shift to something else. If something leads you to a point of confusion, ask for help. Do not think that because you are in this position in your life that A, you will always be in this position, or B, that this prevents you from doing anything about it. Because every single revolution that has succeeded in the past has been led primarily by people in the worst conditions possible, with little to no human rights, with little to no control over anything whatsoever, ownership even of their own labor power in some instances. So we have a real strike in our corner, in our chart, in our side, that says we have history on our side. We have logic, we have the ability to succeed in building a better future for tomorrow, because unlike the society that we have today, it would actually benefit people. Whereas right now, the average person is fighting and pushing and stuffing shit down to convince themselves that this life is the life that they want or need or have to live. But if we were to have something, anything, that could show the people that another life is possible, not just abstract, but is really possible, I do believe more and more every single day that people everywhere, not every people and not every person, but people everywhere would take up the struggle to see that through. And would participate if they saw something for themselves to participate in, something for themselves to have hope in. As we come to a close, the last thing I want to point out is just the fact that, again, one of fascism's largest characteristics is anti-communism, is manipulation, right? The creation of different laws, the use of the education system, religious institutions, fascist unions, if they can even be called that, to drill into the mind of the average person not only just anti-communist thought, but of course anti-Semitic thought, anti-African thought, anti-Slav thought, stuff that created people, turned people into a version of themselves that was willing and able to either blindly be a bystander to what was happening around them or actively participate in it, as we are seeing people today. It stems from, in my humble opinion, anti-communism. And this is why. I think as human beings, genuinely, that we all cannot stomach like pain and suffering in every instance. Now, I do know that the human brain is not a monolith, and that in fact there are people who are medically described as sociopaths or psychopaths who don't feel pain or empathy the same as others, right? Or if at all. But deep down in the heart of just about every single person, at the very least, is an unwillingness to watch themselves or people they care about suffer unnecessarily. Again, pretty big generalization here. But I really do think that that's why so many people turn off their phones right now, right? That's why so many people are not posting on social media. That's why so many people are trying to ignore what is happening, because they just can't stomach it. And to some extent, it is pathetic, because Palestinian children, Congolese children, Sudanese children, Vietnamese children have had to live through horror. And not saying that that should be something that we should romanticize, but the fact that we here in the West kind of have lived in such an incubator for so long, it just makes me question whether or not there's so much of an excuse in the idea that these images and stuff are so traumatizing to watch, because it's even more traumatizing to experience, which may be harsh, but hey, you can critique me if you don't agree with me, because that's what the show's about. Anyways, this anti-communist sentiment, though, this anti-revolutionary sentiment, does not just apply to communists, right? For a couple reasons. One, most people don't really know what a communist is. That's just kind of the truth. Most people don't really know what communism is, or socialism, or revolution. That goes for some so-called socialist, communists, and revolutionaries as well. However, the bigger reason is, of course, propaganda and ruling class control, which has, of course, an enemy in a communist, a socialist, a revolutionary organization or movement. Because what is it that the communist, socialist, or revolutionary says is wrong with society? Exploitation, right? It's not a moral question. It's not a religious question. It's not a racist question. It is a question of power and what that power is used for. By following that logic, anyone can see who is in power, what they're doing to get it, and what is happening to the people who don't have it. Since these things are all true, then the average person comes to the conclusion that these are my enemies, my oppressors, my aggressors, and I need to do something to get them off my back. So, instead, the state wants you to be depressed, or to believe wholeheartedly that the only way forward is the same tools that we've been given for hundreds of years. Elections, representative and parliamentary systems, these types of change. Small, short, oftentimes unsuccessful, if ever, you know, possible, immediately revoked, right? Or co-opted and hollowed out. And because of this, anything that tells you that not only should you not believe that nothing can change and nothing can be done, but that you should know what can be done, what has been done in the past, and what you can and should do to change things in your life, change the world around you. This is dangerous to the state. And so whether it is Hamas or Fidel Castro, whether it's the Communist Party of China or Vladimir Putin, whether it's the indigenous communities in the region of Chiapas, the Zapatistas struggling for their survival, or it's just the people of Iraq resisting invasion. Anti-communist tropes, anti-revolutionary ideas, anti-people interests, anti-human interests predominate and become extremely common on social media, on the news, in everyday conversation. This is the normalization of eugenics. This is the normalization of dystopian nightmares like what we are seeing in Gaza, which should only exist in film screens, talking about an abstract reality that could, in a worst case scenario, come about. But instead, this is the day-to-day reality of the Palestinian people, along with people throughout history, throughout the world. Imperialism, capitalism, fascism, neocolonialism, even Zionism is an international front for control. It is a coordination and collaboration between those who can come to some principled agreements on some shared interest and act together in unity in order to achieve each shared or even differing goal and accomplishment. Which means that our struggles must also be international. I want to thank my very good comrade down in Brazil. I won't say their name, who I was able to get up on the phone with the other day. I would also like to thank a very good friend of mine here locally who has been extremely monumental in the last few weeks and months and years, honestly, of my very good life, which has become better for knowing them and others. Shouts out to you, Amanda. And I also want to thank the Palestinian people, the Congolese people, the Sudanese people, for their sacrifices, for their martyrdom, for their struggles, and for the education that they have given to the world. Because if it was not for the Palestinian struggle, if it was not for the different liberation movements and revolutions that have happened around the world, humanity would exist even less than it does today, which is a crazy thought. And I certainly wouldn't know anything. And I might not be here today. So, lastly, I just want to say that all of this is open to discussion. This is an active conversation that I want to have with anyone who listens. So please, if you would like to come on the show, if you would like to share criticisms, critiques, questions, concerns, comments, send them over to indefenseofliberation@gmail.com or message me at indefenseofliberation on Instagram. Thank you again for listening. And please let me know with your responses and ratings what you think of the program and the series, Colonial Connections, and what I should focus on next. All power to the people, free the land. Free all political prisoners. Long live the revolution and the resistance of the Palestinian people. Long live the struggle of the Congo. Long live the people of Sudan. Long live revolution and resistance everywhere. Peace and love. Stay safe.